Good morning.
Good morning.
And happy Father's Day. I think we all had fathers, so we're gonna give them their due today. We had a program for mothers a few weeks ago, and now it's Father's turn. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. We aspire to be open-hearted and open-minded as a congregation, and we welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, sexual orientation, skin color, gender, or family structure. And we welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities and inabilities. And later on in the service, if we have any visitors or guests, we would love to for you to introduce yourself so we can greet you afterwards. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. Today is one of our lay-led Sundays. Our Mr. Sandra Ingham also leads the service, and next week will be her turn. And today we'll be presenting this program on Father's Day called Father's Day Remembrances. For opening words, I'm going to read a poem by Li Bo, an 8th century Chinese poet. In the land of Wu, the mulberry leaves are green, and thrice the silkworms have gone to sleep. In East Lu, where my father's family stay, I wonder who is sowing those fields of ours. I cannot be back in time for the spring doings, yet I can help nothing traveling on the river. The south wind wafts my homesick spirit and carries it up to the front of our familiar tavern. There I see a peach tree on the east side of the house with thick leaves and branches waving in the blue mist. It is the tree I planted before my parting 3 years ago. The peach tree has grown now as tall as the tavern roof while I have wandered about without returning. Ping Yang, my pretty daughter, I see you stand by the peach tree and pluck a flowering branch. You pluck the flowers, but I am not there. How your tears flow like a stream of water. My little son Po Qin, grown up to your sister's shoulders, you come out with her under the peach tree, but who is there to pat you on the back? When I think of these things, my senses fail, and a sharp pain cuts my heart every day. Now I tear off a piece of white silk to write this letter and send it to you with my love a long way up the river. And now we'll have our chalice lighting with sort of a concocted family, Phoenix and Robin, who often ride to church together.
Intricate and untraceable, weaving and interweaving, dark strand with light, designed beyond all spiderly contrivance to link, not to entrap, elation, grief, joy, contrition, and twine, shaking, changing, forever forming, transforming, all praise to the great web.
Today we're going to have 8 readings about some of the fathers of our Prairie members. And these remembrances, as you might expect at Prairie, show the varying experiences and relationships that children have with their fathers, those people who are sometimes lovable, sometimes playful, and sometimes stern. So I hope you enjoy the readings, and we'll have a chance afterwards for comments and questions. Well, we'll have time. And we have a table on the side with some pictures and other things that you can look at that some of the readers will talk about. So we only have 2 chairs up here, so what I'm going to ask is that we come up in twos. So we'll start off with Robin Proud and Rosemarie Lester.
I have a question to go first because I'm looking at the kids downstairs.
Yes. Actually, I think I'll just put this here.
That mic.
Yeah.
I don't mind, and I'm sure not to be forgotten again.
Well, you're up here.
All right. My father was 10 years old growing up in Brooklyn when his father died, and he decided right then that he was on his own in life. He never had gotten along that well with his mother, and when she remarried, his relationship with his stepfather was even worse. He was self-educated. We were never clear whether he actually graduated from high school, but when he worked in a printing shop, on break, the other guys would be reading the comic books that were printed there, and he would be reading the New York Review of Books or similar. He was very political. He was a union organizer, a socialist, an atheist, and a pacifist. Although his family was Jewish and his brothers went into the armed services in World War II, he was a conscientious objector and was put in prison. At one point, there was a presidential amnesty, and he was allowed to do alternative service in a mental hospital. When I was about 8 and my older brother told me our father had been in jail, I was horrified. But later, when I was in college, in the Vietnam era, and my friends were burning draft cards, I bragged about my dad. And it was through his resistance that my parents met, as my mother worked for the War Resisters League, a pacifist organization. My father was the driving force behind my parents' decision to move away from New York City and buy a small farm on the Pennsylvania-New York border. I think he liked the idea of working for himself as much as getting out of the city. He took what was basically a cabin and built onto it, added plumbing and electricity. And in this too, he was self-taught, so some things were a little odd, but it basically worked. And he also learned just from books and from talking to people what he needed to know to raise sheep. The farm never was self-supporting, it was small. So my father had other jobs in town, and once we kids started school, my mother became the main breadwinner. I was not happy about this because, of course, on TV I learned that fathers were supposed to go to work and mothers were supposed to stay home and bake cookies. Not that my mother ever did that. Because he was home, my father took over cooking, laundry, childcare, and it turned out he really liked cooking, which my mother had never cared for. So by the time they retired, he was doing all the grocery shopping, cooking, dishwashing, laundry, and he was very happy with that. Although my father was committed to his farm, he was more committed to his kids. So when it became clear that the tiny local schools couldn't offer much, we moved to Philadelphia, where my brother and I were able to be in accelerated programs. And my dad went back and forth to the farm for some time. In 1962, Philadelphia was beginning a huge urban renewal project. There were blocks of nothing but rubble, punctuated by streets that had small communities, and one would be Puerto Rican, Ukrainian. Well, my dad discovered an island of a few blocks where there was an old-time Jewish neighborhood. He surprised the shopkeepers by speaking to them in Yiddish, which had been his first language. And I think it was almost like a theme park for him that he found this little street that was a remembrance of the good parts of his childhood, which hadn't been many. He had some not so fond memories of childhood, but he really enjoyed that. So my mother advanced her career in social work so much that my father ended up not farming anymore. They moved to several other cities based on her work. My father had absolutely no problem with his wife making more money, having a good job title. He was very proud of her intelligence and accomplishments. And he would get jobs in warehouses or other manual labor and he'd get along with everyone wherever he worked. He never felt he was defined by his job. You can tell from this summary that my dad had zero concern for what other people thought of him or what society said a man should or shouldn't do. He was equally at home with immigrant coworkers in New York City and farmers and upstate, with educated professionals. In fact, he often had a distrust of those who claimed to be experts. And he always enjoyed kids. Wherever we lived, he got to know the kids, and he had never forgotten what it was like to be a kid. He lived life on his own terms, according to his own values, and he really enjoyed life. When he died just shy of 86 years old, he had just finished adding a room to his house, and he had lots more plans. Growing up with a father like this, I had really high expectations for my husband.
Oh, that's great. Oh, boy.
I'm going to talk about mein Vati, which is what I called my dad in German. My father and I were both only children, raised with great love and understanding. He only lived for 49 years. Then he died of starvation and exposure in a Russian camp. But during those 19 years I had him, he was my God with a small g. I will just give you a few memories because it still is hard to talk about a lot. When I was about 11 and seriously into classical piano, I somehow got my hands on a button accordion and had a ball with it trying my hand at pop music. Never told my piano teacher, of course. A year later, my dad told me that one of his colleagues had a daughter about my age who wanted a piano accordion for Christmas. So would I help this man pick one out, since I was such a musical kid? Well, it hurt a little, but I felt very, well, flattered too. The colleague thanked me profusely, and the carefully chosen accordion wound up under our Christmas tree with my name on it, and I still have it, of course. When I was 10, a bit of a lonely child, I was an only child and no cousins or anything around, I wanted so badly to join the Nazi organization for the 10 to 14 years old, that was the time when I was growing up under the Nazis, with their uniforms, the kids who went camping, marching, singing in groups. My mom absolutely nixed it. But Dad said, let her go. She'll soon be tired of it. And he was right, of course. The first time I marched off to camp, had to sleep on a hard wooden barn floor, and worse yet, had to share my favorite gummy bear candy with all the other kids, my enthusiasm vanished into thin air. When I was about 14, that was time to be confirmed at that time in the Lutheran church. My dad, who never went to church, gave me a wonderful book about Shakespeare with this dedication. Be ye therefore wise as the serpent, but without fault as the dove. And I'll say it again. Be ye therefore wise as the serpent, but without fault as the dove. It was a quote from Matthew from the New Testament. And at the time, I didn't quite understand it. But my dad just smiled and assured me I would later. And he was right again. The older I became, the more deeply I understood the quote, and with it, my father, the mensch and his life's philosophy. And I remember those happy, peaceful Sunday noons when Mutti, my mom, and Elsie, our housekeeper, were preparing Sunday dinner in the kitchen. That was in the early times of the war when there was still enough food. And Dad and I sat close, listening to the radio classical concerts. And yes, being happily silent together with Dad, that was wonderful, and I've never forgotten that feeling. We just didn't need to talk to be content together. It was that kind of a relationship. This was wartime, and Dad was drafted. And when he had to go to port, it was I who was allowed to take him to the train. He really couldn't stand emotional goodbyes, he said, and my mom was surely going to go through that. And at this point, it became obvious to the adult later that he was a wonderful dad. But years later, in some talk therapy, I had to admit I would have had problems with him as a husband. Dad was discharged from the army for medical reasons. And indeed, there were issues when he came home because my mother had become rather independent during his absence. She had started to work again. She had been a young banker when they got married. At the end of the war, Dad was ordered to call the neighborhood Volkssturm together. That was one of those insane Nazi ideas. Those were the old, the sick, and the two young males who were still around at home. He was supposed to get to a certain place and hand them some weapons called the Panzerfaust, the Panzer Fist, for a last-ditch attack on the approaching Soviet soldiers. You could already hear them shooting. My dad called the hapless crew together and quietly told them to go home to their families and not show their faces until it was all over, for which, of course, he could have been shot. When it was indeed all over, the marauding Soviet soldiers were turned loose for 4 days, and we lucked out. There came an officer called Commandant with a soldier with a big Tommy gun. Horrible things there. They saw our grand piano, my accordion, and the Commandant asked in German, he knew how to speak German, he was from the Ukraine, who played? Well, guess who played? For nearly a week he came. I played. They brought some bread and kept the marauding soldiers away. When the Commandant had to move on, my dad sort of installed me in the attic under a bed or next to a bed under which I was supposed to creep. And when soldiers wanted to come in downstairs, he motioned upstairs and said, "Commandant." It worked every time. The Russian soldiers were always afraid to go upstairs in houses because of a fear of snipers. Then one day, the janitor of my dad's office building showed up with a heavily armed Soviet soldier, motioned for my dad to get his coat, and proceeded to take him away. A room full of women looking on in fright. My mom and I were not even allowed to come close to him. And the last I saw of my dad was this gesture. That was in May 1945. In January 1946, the coldest winter on record, he was already dead. We found that out in 1948 from a survivor of the camp where he died. And the last things the survivor wrote to my mom and me, that he always tried to raise and calm the spirits of the people in the camp, which was a mishmash of people who just happened to be at the wrong place and in the wrong place at the wrong time. Women, Nazi officials, anti-Nazis, and a bunch of teenagers who had been talked into calling themselves werewolves. It's a fantastic thing. Anyway, so my father kept soothing the people's spirit, and he was always very, very good at that. And he kept telling the people to, quote, "have faith in our women who will get us out of here." Well.
Okay, is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. Great, thank you. Next we'll have Terry Prudlow and Carl Wacker. Oh, I'm sorry, Ruth. Ruth Calden and Terry Prudlow. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. I go first, sure. Okay, mine is a very short poem of my own. I think you'll find it a very Unitarian poem. I'll try again. You hear me now? Okay. Mine is a very short poem that I wrote that involves my father. I think you'll find it a very Unitarian poem, dealing with a part of my religious development, which I'm long past, okay? It's called "God Has Red Hair." It was easy for me to understand the love of God. In the Bible stories my mother read to me, God's love was a father's love. My father was a red-headed man with large hands and a gentle touch. I remember being lifted to his shoulders or up onto the tractor seat, being talked to eye. I was Punkin, he was Pa. When I was 8, he died. And missing him so much, I easily adopted Christ. The fantasy was comfort to me, letting me reassemble Papa. letting me find again those same strong hands to run to. My dad, Neil DeBryan, was a remarkable man. He grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in a strict Dutch Calvinist home, one of 10 children. He had an eighth grade education and 1 year of business college, and felt lucky to have a job during the Great Depression as a Prudential insurance salesman. After meeting my mother, he became a devout Methodist and a tither. Now this sounds very ordinary and conventional, but in his leisure hours, Dad flourished, and that's where he made his mark on me. He played the trombone, he sang in the choir, he enjoyed records of opera, and he liked New Orleans jazz. On Saturday night, he projected 2 movie shorts using our refrigerator as a screen, featuring Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton. He taught me the constellations in the winter sky and to identify bloodroot and hepatica in the spring. And there were often surprises when I came home. Cracked ground wheat from a local mill, water from a spring, milk herring for Sunday breakfast, and goat's milk for me to try after I'd read Heidi. We took jaunts in the countryside, just the two of us, to find hickory nuts or fresh cider in the fall. One summer, he dug a pit in our backyard to bake beans on hot rocks while my mother protested, "But Neil, the oven is so much easier, handy." I was fascinated by his stories of his year in France during World War I, servicing 14-inch naval guns that were mounted on railroad cars. Fastidious about cleanliness, he had brought his own mess kit along in the U.S. and cleaned it with coffee because water was scarce and sanitation deplorable in France. On refusing to use a regulation mess kit, he was hauled before an officer who said, "Oh, keep your kit. You have more foresight than any man in this regiment." He prized getting letters, especially those from my mother, because they included a stick of blackjack gum. And in his pocket, he kept a small New Testament, and what is rarer, a copy of the Stoic Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. "Though your feet are in the mud, your head can be in the clouds," he said, summing up Aurelius. In our living room was a bookcase holding Dad's secondhand set of Harvard's classics, which he read trying to fill the gaps of his meager education. "Some people think I'm well-read," he said, "but I'm only skimming the surface." He loved Boswell's Life of Johnson, Washington Irving's Sketchbook, Isaac Walton's The Complete Angler, and all the New England poets. But his all-time favorite writer was Thoreau, and I have his copy of Walden over there. And every spring, he reread Walden. Thoreau was his mentor as well. And anyone in the family contemplating a purchase, he would caution, "Simplify, simplify." Or quote Thoreau's, "A man is rich in proportion to the number of things he can afford to let alone." One day he announced he was going to build a one-room retreat for himself in our garage. Like Thoreau's cabin at Walden Pond, it would be a place for reading and contemplation. My mother protested, "Neil, why would you want to be out there in the garage away from the rest of us?" "I won't always be alone," he replied, smiling. "I'll have 3 chairs, like Thoreau, 1 for solitude, 2 for friendship, and 3 for company." From my dad, I learned to love literature and recognize the power of poetry, to lift one out of the ordinary into the transcendental. He would quote Whittier, "We cut the solid whiteness through while shoveling our snowy walks," and savored Whittier's description of snow etching a tree, and the smallest twig on the elm tree wore ermine too dear for an earl. Emerson's Forbearance was another favorite. "Hast thou named all the birds without a gun?"
loved the wood rose and left it on its stalk. He loved William Cullen Bryant's To a Wild Fowl and Thanatopsis about approaching death with trust. Thou go not like a quarry slave at night scourged to the dungeon, but sustained and soothed by an unfaltering trust, approach thy grave. In 1949, when George and I were newly married and living in a student efficiency in Ann Arbor, my folks arrived with a bushel of hickory nuts for Christmas fudge and old time's sake, said Dad. And around the rim, he had painted in black words, Whittier's Snowbound, and close at hand, the basket stood with nuts from brown October's wood. Waves of nostalgia swept over me, but a bushel of hickory nuts in our cramped apartment? After weeks of colliding with the basket, we put it outside for the Michigan squirrels. The squirrels had a heyday, but I did not. Every glance out the window at the emptying basket brought me a ripple of regret. After all, do you know any squirrels who appreciate lines from Whittier or whose dads bring them a bushel of nuts in November? After a life of illnesses, of no illnesses except for colds, my dad died suddenly of angina at 62, and I flew home with a nursing baby. But and marveled how an ordinary life can be so extraordinary.
Great, thank you. Carl Wacker and Doug Rink. I'm sure as during these readings, we recognize some of the traits of our own fathers.
Sure, I can go first. Hello. I'm going to talk about someone who is not historically a father to me, but a father influence. Of course, I'm going to talk about my father-in-law, Joel Garrett, Julie's dad. I actually did not have the pleasure of growing up with him, and I can only imagine what that would have been like. But from what I know about him, he's just a really easy guy to write about because he's just a wonderful man in every respect. And he's everything one might expect from a dad. He was a great businessman. He was reliable and dependable. He was true to his word and a warm, kind individual. He was someone you could talk to if you need a good listener. But he's very careful not to judge hastily. And he's always got some good advice and words of comfort. So it's easy to imagine, if you know his daughter Julie, what a wonderful charitable influence she had from him. He was a father to all, not just his immediate offspring. He and Julie's mom were foster parents to many and adopted one and valued as their own. Not too long ago, Julie and I were volunteering at a community dinner at a homeless shelter in Gainesville called St. Francis House. And we were there and we saw this young mother and her four-year-old daughter and in this unfortunate set of circumstances that led them to there. And Julie told Joel about this situation, and that evening Joel just didn't sit right with him, and he had to make some changes in their life. And within days or weeks, Joel would help them find housing and transportation and employment, just strictly through his network of friends and business people that he knew in town. And then when the little girl did find herself in a very serious situation, Joel and his wife did take them into her house for safety for nearly a year. And kind of informal network of hospital visitations grew into this most wonderful hospital ministry through his church. It was really just, he was visiting some friends from church who were in the hospital, and he just saw a need that there were people in the hospitals and all kinds of situations that had a lot of little needs. This visitation program kind of grew into a ministry called the Special Angel Group or Angel Fund. And and Joel has helped dozens of families who have mostly children waiting for heart transplants and other life-threatening illnesses like cancer and different things. He's arranged for housing, meals. While this is Gainesville is a lot like Madison. It has a teaching hospital, a lot of research hospitals, and people come from all over the state. And what do they do while their loved ones are in the hospital? So they are often have to travel back and forth, and they need help with meals. They're in special assistance programs where they just don't have places to stay overnight. But through this fund and his own generosity, a lot of times he's helped with temporary housing and transportation and child care and a lot of other things. But mostly it's caring and comfort and positive thoughts and prayer blankets and a lot of interesting things. You know, he's a real inspiration. They call him the Encourager. He actually has like 700 friends on Facebook. He's just an amazing networker, and this is kind of what I see as God's work. You know, he's bringing sunshine into the lives of those who are in their greatest moment of need. He bonds with these families he supports. You know, he's there when the family gets the phone call that their 2-year-old son has got the heart that's being donated by some tragedy, and he's also there at the funerals of some of these families when people haven't made it through, and he's really these families take him in because of so much that he's helped them through. He was recently featured on Good Morning America with a high school senior who could not attend her graduation. So he had the principal and the teachers come to the hospital, and it was just an amazing segment. And he's modest, and he says, "Oh, I just made a few phone calls," but really. And there was another girl who was a cancer patient who could not attend her high school prom, and he arranged to have the prom brought to the hospital and had her dressed up, put on a pretty prom dress, and they had music, and unhooked her from her IV for a few hours so she could dance with her boyfriend. It was really touching. So Joel is the father that has inspired the goodness in my wife. He could have done many things with the success he's had in business life, but he's turned his good fortune into good deeds. And sometimes he brings his smile or his warmth. I'm just very grateful that he's accepted me into their family. And that's Joel.
My dad's 89 years old and still lives independently with my mom in Mendota, the small town where I grew up. He was recently diagnosed with acute leukemia and probably has only months to live, so I welcome this opportunity to tell you about him. My dad's a wonderful father in person. Much of my better self I owe to him. He has a quiet way of teaching by example. Honesty, humility, fair play, compassion, and common sense, hard work, and a playful sense of humor are all characteristics that stand out. Paula says he reminds her a little of Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. Life for my dad has never been about what he can get for himself, but about how he can help others. I'm thankful that he's always supported me. If he was ever disappointed in my choices, he never showed it. Dad was born in 1924 and grew up in the small town of LaSalle on the Illinois River. His childhood sounds like something out of the movie Stand By Me. With his friends, he rode his bike all over town and roamed the countryside with a fishing pole and a BB gun. He rode horses, milked cows, and harvested corn by hand. I'd like to tell two childhood stories. When Dad was in his early teens, he and some friends skipped school to go skinny dipping in a farm creek. A chicken came along and one of them shot it with his BB gun. They didn't want to waste the chicken, so still unclothed, they tried to cook it over an open fire. But the farmer surprised them and took all their clothes back to the farmhouse. He came back out angry and with an axe handle in hand and demanded they pay a dollar for the chicken. But they had no money. So finally he gave them their underwear so they could go in the house and make a phone call. They called the treasurer of their scout troop, who biked out and paid the farmer, and the crisis was over. About the same time period, he and some friends were crossing the Illinois River Railroad Bridge to fish on the other side. They got caught by a train, barreling down on them, whistle blowing. There was nowhere to go, and the drop to the river was over 60 feet. They scooted out on the ties as far as they dared, and they lay as flat as they could while the train thundered by just inches away. They all survived unscathed, but he never told his mother about this close call. Life got serious for my dad when he was 17 years old. He was shot in a hunting accident and nearly died. He spent almost a year in the hospital and in a full body cast. He's walked with a cane ever since because the doctors couldn't fully repair the damage to his leg. If there's a silver lining to his injury, I guess it's that it kept him out of the war, although I'm sure he would have willingly served as his father did. His time in the hospital convinced him to become a doctor. He graduated from the University of Illinois Medical School and set up a family practice with his brother in Mendota, just 12 miles from where he grew up. He married my mom, a hometown girl, and before long they had four children, three girls and a boy, Carl. My dad had a sliding scale for his medical care. I remember patients who couldn't pay cash coming by the house to deliver a dozen eggs or a basket of vegetables, which he always accepted as full payment. For many years, he was an old-time country doctor, going on house calls, delivering babies, completing minor surgeries, counseling, and providing basic care. He was the on-call local doctor for the railroad and for the high school football team. He worked hard, often up in the middle of the night, and routinely working 60-hour weeks. My dad was a very busy man, but he always found time to spend with me and his family. He took me to Cubs games in Chicago and remains an always hopeful Cubs fan to this day. He loves the outdoors and spent many days with me fishing, camping, and canoeing. For many years, he took me on an annual week-long fishing adventure in Canada. We took a family vacation every summer, usually camping in a trailer he built with a friend. I have wonderful memories of camping in Florida, Colorado, Canada, and many other places. He continued this tradition well into his 80s, working with my mother to plan family vacations that brought together his four children and 11 grandchildren. My dad has a strong sense of compassion and fairness. Years ago, he received an inheritance, but his brother and two sisters were not included, so he split the inheritance so all would get a share. After his longtime nurse retired, circumstances left her without a place to live. So he set up a living space in the basement of his medical office for her. He asked for no rent, only that she not fill the building with the odor of cooking chicken during office hours. Even today, he's thinking of others, concerned that his medical care isn't taking scarce resources from those who might benefit more, and wanting to be reassured that his children and grandchildren are all okay.
Okay, we're nearing the end here. Mechie Butler. And I was going to read an anonymous piece, but we won't have time, so Mechie will be the last.
This is my dad. I will put them on the table later. I don't have many pictures of him because of the family circumstances that kept getting us together and apart again. And I was able to find one item that he made. And I show it to you now because it's so very delicate. It's made out of a peanut, and it's a rabbit. And I will put this over on the table and ask you not to pick it up.
She is.
I have it here. Ask you not to pick it up because it's pretty old. That would be 1941, this peanut. Memories of my dad, John Alden Kaplan. My dad was a tremendously creative guy. I was fortunate to have had two such parents, as I've been a lifelong artist myself, much from their influences, although I think my own sense of curiosity has also been important. But today is about fathers, and I learned a great deal at my dad's knee, watching how he did things, techniques I still use today, how to make a three-dimensional top hat out of flat paper, for instance, using tabs and glue, or how to make an axle of wire to create a cardboard horse with movable joints for puppetry. many little tricks that he invented himself as needs would arise. When I was 3, he taught me how to load my watercolor brush with paint, still retaining the point needed to apply detail. And long before I'd ever heard of a rhyming dictionary, he created a clever little wheel of cardboard, which rotated would offer numerous sounds going through the alphabet for writing poetry. It was a rhyming wheel. I still have the small wooden horse with a mane and tail of string and movable legs he carved for me, somewhere. And one time, letting me watch as it evolved, he carved me a tiny basket out of a hazelnut. He was one of these guys who always carried a pocket knife, of an era that sadly passed now. Today it's a weapon. But then there was the time when my mother offered, as a special treat for us 3 children, an opportunity to work with her fancy Italian oil-based clay for sculpture. And it wasn't like we didn't already have water-based clay, because we did. An enamel potful, which my mom kept moist by adding water whenever it began to dry out. She had found and harvested it from the roots of a tree that had fallen down in our yard. But this was a very special opportunity, and we had to agree that at the end of our play, we would consent to recombine our creations back into her working material. We understood we could not keep what we made. So we spent an hour or so and enjoyed working the clay, creating various objects as we each imagined. And I had made a kitty curled up on a cushion. And I was quite proud and pleased with my kitty. But then time came when we had to relinquish our creations, and I did not want my kitty to be squished back into the clay lump. Protests and tears followed, and my 8-year-old self could not be consoled. Then my dad came to my rescue. He said, "I can fix it so you don't have to give it up, but you can still give back that clay." Thereupon, he made a plaster cast of the little creation and restored the oil clay to my mom's cache. The piece is only about 2 inches square, but a precious object in memory of my dad's creativity and love.
As long as you have the ability to tell your parents you love them and appreciate them, do it. This will not always be the case. Please greet your neighbor and greet the new members. Thanks for coming.